Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode of the HYM podcast. Here today is the usual suspects. It's Nick and Jake with me. How are we doing, boys?
Yeah, all good, mate. All good. All good.
Where about? I think you're both in Germany, aren't you?
Yeah, when everyone would have last heard us, I was in Monaco for supporting the FE boys. Nick was about to be racing. What, you were about, pretty race weekend, weren't you, Nick?
Yeah, I think, I don't know whether it was this one that's just gone or the one before, because obviously 2 weekends on the bounce. But yeah, I'm sat in the same room as I have been for the last 5 or 6 weeks. So
you were out there qualifying for the 24 hours of the Nürburgring, Nick, in the 6-hour race. How did that go?
Yeah, I mean, if we talk about the race before first, that was pretty solid. The Porsche seemed to be very, very fast, and yeah, we can't keep with them at the moment, but we're doing our homework, and hopefully come the 24 we'll be good. I saw a few tweets and questions on the HYM channel yesterday about what happened in qualifying. To quote Kimi Raikkonen, I crashed. and that was it's about it. When you make a small mistake at that circuit, it bites you hard. And thankfully, the team did a brilliant job to get it all back up and running and into top 30 qualifying. And eventually, we finished eighth, which was still pretty solid. So, all ready, all prepped for the Nürburgring 24 hours in a couple of weeks' time, at least. And no injuries to speak of. So, happy days.
Well, as someone who has a lot of experience doing what you did at the weekend in crashing you'll be all right.
I'll be all right. I'll climb back on the horse.
But who have we got on today, boys?
Yeah, so we actually have an ex-teammate of mine, Mr. Ollie Webb, professional racing driver, ELMS champion, and king content creator. His channel seemed to be gathering a lot of momentum, 100,000 followers or so on Instagram, so a bit of a legend. So how are you doing, Ollie? All good?
Yeah, good. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited to be on, and very jealous of your Nürburgring exploits. I've always wanted to fire something quick around there, but still haven't got the chance to.
Oh, yeah, you have to do it. If there was one circuit I could just race for the rest of my life, it would be that one, because
really?
You never get the same situation twice because of traffic and the slow cars. Like yesterday, there was a Dacia racing, which is like 4 or 5 minutes a lap slower. So you can imagine the closing speed with a GT3 when you're coming, say through some flat out corners, minimum speed's 230, and it's sat in the middle doing 80. It can get quite hairy. but you really, really have to. So where are you at the moment, Ollie? All still coaching and doing all that kind of stuff?
Yes, we've been testing the GT4 today with the McLaren team. So I've been at Silverstone here again tomorrow, doing some filming stuff with Michelin and Porsche. So I'm at my premiere in Silverstone, Green Man. You'll know from your previous days, but I'm sure you've got different regular hotels now to what you used to.
Yeah, it's not all in the UK anymore, but still miss the Green Man, if I'm honest. I've spent plenty of night there, getting up at silly o'clock in the morning to get, I'm sure Jake has as well, and Alex.
Good probably. Breakfast.
The banging breakfast. Yeah. So I'm sure you'll be looking forward to that tomorrow. What are you racing this year? We'll go straight on actually into that, because you are racing, aren't you?
Yeah, so it's pretty busy. So as usual, kind of the last few years anyway, especially now with everything going on around the world, it seems to be more and more last minute than ever. So it went from kind of no seat wondering what's happening, because the LMP1 privateer project of Bicolors is taking a year off before they enter their hypercar. So that kind of fell through, in the sense that there's only going to be testing for me. And then I got a ELMS seat with LMP2. So I'll be doing that, doing the full season of WEC and Le Mans, which is great. Then I'll be doing GT4 in GT Cup and British GT with my AM driver here in the UK, who I was testing with today in the McLaren. And then I'll also be doing another championship, which is to be announced, but I've been testing it recently for anyone who's kind of seen on my page. That's TBC. And then a lot of classic stuff. So I'm racing Jag E-Type, a Porsche SWB, and an Endurance Racing Legends, an old prototype in a load of classic stuff as well. So I'm in 6 championships this year, albeit a lot of them are classic stuff. So it's gone busy all of a sudden.
Yeah, that's mad. I do see, obviously, we follow each other on social media and whatnot, and you are flat out. Like, sometimes I think I'm flat out, and then I think, no, actually, you're in a different hotel, a different country, a different racetrack, a different car. Literally, it looks like 5 or 6 days a week at the moment. So better to be busy, I guess, than sat on the sofa, but pretty flat out.
Also, so, yeah, I mean, What's it like going between all those championships, Ollie?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. I mean, that's where I've always found is kind of getting to that like 90-95% in a load of different cars quite quickly. That's always what I've kind of has been my niche, whether it's doing some of the kind of stunt driving work I do with films and TV programs or getting in coaching and driving in all these different cars, is I find kind of that last kind of, well, I say the first 95% fairly quickly. And I find I can switch my brain quite quickly. Finding that last couple of percent is always the tough bit. And I'm sure Nick will allude to it at some point, but he was much quicker than me when he was in World Series. And he's always good at finding that last percent or two. So that's where kind of the big boys, you know, get to Formula One, and that's how they do that. But I'm a bit of an expert switching into loads of different cars. But yeah, it's find that last percent in the ball. It is tough. I think if you get two cars that are too similar to each other, then it's a bit more confusing. But because, you know, 1 minute I'm, you know, flat in a roos in a prototype car, and the next minute I'm sideways 20 mile an hour in a Porsche in the rain, it's you can kind of separate your mind as like two completely different sports almost.
I guess that's why that's your selling point, isn't it, though? Like, why you say you were so close to the season starting and thinking what was going to happen racing wise, and then all of a sudden you're kind of inundated with stuff, it seems. That must be one of the reasons why.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. And obviously you guys know there's plenty of drivers out there, and there's plenty of people willing to take the opportunity for any seat. So that's another reason why it tends to be last minute. This kind of evolving world of motorsport towards the pro-am push has definitely helped in keeping our bums in seats. We'd all love for it to be professional only and only against the best all the time. That's what we all want, kind of being at the peak of what we do. But this pro-am atmosphere does help generate these last minute seats with someone who's got that experience, who's, you know, reliable and will do a quick enough job.
That's for sure. I mean, yeah, which you will do in all of those. Obviously, I know you're super fast from when we were teammates a little bit. If we take it before that, the first time we actually raced was when you were in 2 liters. So you were with Fortec. I think I came in possibly with Fortec to start with as well in 2009. So I think maybe you were in your second year of 2 liters, but you were challenging for the championship from what I remember. Just talk us through from when you started racing even into karting and whatnot.
Yeah, so I started karting, I'd say late. I think I was maybe 12 years old, which is kind of late-ish for what should be these days when they're kind of thrown in into cadets. And I only did mini max and junior max. And I think I just did basically a year and maybe a year and a half. Club stuff only. Won one championship and was second or third in the other, so did quite well, and thought, oh, you know what, I'm definitely the next Lewis Hamilton. I'll jump in and do a Super One round, and then very quickly realised that I am both nowhere near Super One level, and we either need to commit to this fully or look at a different path. And at that point, although I loved it, it was a hobby, and that long ago, it wasn't that expensive. It was expensive. It's more expensive than going kicking a football in a field, but you still weren't spending crazy money at club level karting. You go and spend a few hundred quid or max £1,000 over a whole weekend worth of racing. And then when we found out how much Super One was and how much, you know, you can get into almost six figures if you go professional karting, we kind of just called it a little bit quits. But then I ended up in T-Cars with a bit of sponsorship and did that championship, which was really exciting, you know, being a 14-year-old in a car that can do over 100 mile an hour. And we had some good guys in there, Quaife Hobbs and Chilton and Palmer and Bichetta, and some good names who have gone to do good things. And that's when it kind of started getting a little bit serious, like, oh, you know, we're quite good at this, and cars seem to suit me even more than go-karts. And that's when Formula Renault came about. That's when our paths crossed, and that's when I started fighting for single-seater championships amongst some good people. And Formula Renault and Formula 3 were both probably very close. Probably, say, maybe Formula 3 edged it a bit compared to Formula Renault, but those were my favourite years ever in racing. Formula Renault was a tough pill to swallow, because I think I led the championship from round one till the second to last round, or second to last weekend. And back then there was drop scores, and after drop scores, I ended up coming third in the championship, I think. Third in the championship. But loved that. And but then I went into Formula 3. Shall I just keep going? I don't know. Am I meant to keep going through the path?
No. Go ahead. Yeah. It's interesting to talk. Obviously, we'll fly in if we've got any particular questions, but just a general summary / overview of the career can be good, and then we can pick up as and when we want.
Cool. Yeah, so then I ended up in Formula 3. Really loved those cars. It was 2010, so it was the last year second to last year before Formula 3 got quite restricted in its rules, which has its pluses and downsides. But the exciting part of that championship was European Formula 3 was struggling at the time. There was about 9 cars in it, which made it really exciting for English Formula 3 because we had a completely full grid, and all the kind of Europeans had come over, and obviously Jean-Éric Vergne and Felipe Nasr, and kind of a big grid. And then the English guys as well with Collado and everyone else that were in it made it really competitive. And it was open. So it was VW against Mercedes. I was a Mercedes driver and had a Mercedes contract, so I was able to do Formula 3 funded partly by them, which really helped me in the ability to have a good engine behind me. But then also it was open, so you had the Carlin spending big money in wind tunnel and Fortec spending their money on suspension development. So the cars were actually quite different, to the point where I actually have a good memory from Spa where I only just qualified pole by, I think it was a couple of hundredths, but I was about 8/10 off in the middle sector because the cars were just completely different. The Carlin car was super quick in the high speed and we were super quick in the mechanical stuff and the tight twisty bits. And then I probably jumped into World Series a little bit too quickly. Probably should have done another year in Formula 3, challenged for the title midway through, but then Vergne was way too dominant towards the end, so came third in that. Jumped up into World Series, really quick car, loved driving them. But wasn't quite on my game, I think, when I was in that championship. So ended up going out to America to do Indy Lights, which was the older car. So it was kind of a bit of a bathtub with a gearbox, but a big engine behind it. But the tracks and the people and the way of life and everything, I just totally fell in love with. And if I wasn't quite as in the deep end with oval racing as the way my introduction was, I probably would have stayed out there. But my first ever oval race was Vegas, and I was in the Sam Schmidt Jr. team, and obviously Sam Schmidt's driver was Dan Weldon, who passed away. And then my next oval, I broke my foot and my knee, and then the next oval, we had a huge crash in the Freedom 100, sorry. So I was kind of two crashes in, and one teammate passed away, and I was like, oh. And I wasn't really enjoying the ovals that much anyway, so I thought street courses and road courses, great, ovals, not so much. Came back to Europe and then began my endurance career, which has been from 2014 till now. Won the European Le Mans Championship, been on the podium at Le Mans, won Asian Le Mans in that, and a few kind of GT 24-hour races in between. But I won't go into too much detail with all those. Feels weird speaking about your own career in that way, but it's fun memory.
I like it when we do the complete overview of a career.
Yeah,
because it's like, well, now we can just like hop back into it. Everyone knows what we're dealing with now.
So. Yeah. Exactly. That was my plan.
I actually do like it because we've had a couple of drivers come on. They're like, should we dip into this bit now? And it's like, whatever. You know, we enjoy going back to it. So I was going to go right back again. So you only did a year and a half, you said, of karting. And we've had a couple of drivers on, the likes of like Sheldon van der Linde jumps to mind. You know, he didn't do too much karting, but he jumped into a it was like the polo series.
Polo, yeah.
And, you know, what something I'm sort of noticing is the guys who have sort of got out of karting early and into a car have actually had quite successful careers off the back of it. Do you think jumping out of a car early and getting in a car early really helps you like sort of like form the start of your ability almost?
Yeah, it definitely does. I think it is twofold. I think one is, if you stay in the karting world a little bit too long, A, you'll spend a lot of money, especially as you try and climb the ladder to more expensive classes, more expensive races. And B, it doesn't always translate. Now, that being said, if you are at the top of your game and you win, you know, world championships or European championships or Super One or whatever, you're naturally going to be fairly quick in anything. But the reverse side of that is if you're mid-pack in those championships and then keep pushing to keep doing it more and more and more, when actually if you realise you just kind of came out of that world and tried a car, it's a very different driving style. And you, as long as you've got the basics and you're good enough, you know, if you're mid-pack in Super One or in any European World Championship in a go-kart, there's a strong chance you could be good, if not better, in a car. And I learned those skills in a car very early. You know, at 13, 14, I was testing that T car at airfields and getting used to car control. And there's a few other drivers that have done similar. And yeah, I think it translates really well into a good career.
Is T cars like what we have now with Ginés Juniors, kind of?
Yeah, kind of. It was a space frame chassis. It was a little bit quicker top end, a little bit, looked a bit more like a BTCC car in the sense that it was larger. But for at the time it was T cars, Junior Ginetta just came out, and then it was like Saxmax, I think.
The guy that springs to mind is a good friend of ours, is Seb Morris, because he basically tells the same story that he said he was in karting where, and he couldn't believe how much, you know, people were spending, and he basically had no chance unless he was going to spend on their level effectively, especially on engines, Super One. And he said he just jumped out of into a Formula Renault, but then straight away into a Ginetta Junior, and he won. And he said he straight away said it was the best thing he ever did. There was no reason for him to stay around in karting. So it seems like you say, if you stay along in too long in karting, you can easily, you know, find yourself sort of spending far too much, and then suffering even to get into the first step of car racing world.
Yeah, exactly. I think making that jump, especially with these championships now that allow younger drivers to come in, is a good, wise move. And also, it tells you the other way around. If you're not good and you're crap and you get into cars and you find out, I really don't suit this, I only suit karting, it also tells you your path quite early at a young age, which is, okay, if I want to carry on karting, it will be a hobby, because the karting's never going to lead to Formula One anyway, because I've tried cars and I wasn't very good in it. So that would be a tough pill to swallow as a young kid. But at least if you go in there early and tried it for 1 or 2 years and you literally are nowhere and it's not working, then at least you know.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you see quite a few of the karting families actually fizzle out in terms of finances, like you've mentioned. So they're super good and they're chasing that European or world title, and they're spending 100, 150,000 when they could have been doing some testing in a 2-litre Renault or whatnot. And then they go to make the jump and they realise it's the same cost, but they've already spent all the money that they've saved. So then they never actually get to see if they're good enough.
Mate, I remember someone in karting, I won't name his name, but he briefly got onto the RSF programme in karting, and the chassis was a top kart chassis. It wasn't the best at all. And it was no doubt not going to win the championship in it, but he was doing a good job in it. And he decided to leave the RSF program mid-season to go and jump on a Tony car so he could try and win the championship. And it's just like that. It's a bit short-sighted in a way.
It can happen. And people just are short-sighted in motorsport in any sense, I guess, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing I'm very jealous of with you, Ollie, is you kind of got to race in the prime of British F3. I started karting when I was in 2010, but then karting cars 2013. At that point, it was already two or three years out of its prime, really. I think 2011 was probably its last good year. And I remember how many guys were racing in it at the top level, guys like you say, Jeb and Ricardo and people like this. I'm so jealous that you got to race at that time.
Yeah, it was it definitely makes me a little bit nostalgic, and definitely realized that I'm definitely no longer classed as a young racing driver, because I actually had a new form of three cars, and you know, you kind of start thinking, oh, it was different in my day, and you're like, oh,
I'm not one of those anymore. Now. Yeah.
But yeah, 2010, 2011, those F3 cars were just wicked, and it almost didn't matter so much that, I mean, we knew how much Carlin was spending, and the Chilterns had just bought Carlin at that time, and we knew they had a good wind tunnel and a lot of progress and development, but it almost didn't matter so much, because you knew if you can do your bit, you would get the attention, because people knew which cars were quick, which were spending the money on engines. I mean, there was even quali engines then. I mean, I even remember once we left Magny-Cours, we were leading the championship, VW just came to the next round, and Vern would just go out in each quali, do 3 laps, and just come in with a motor that's pretty much smoking out the back, literally on fire, and just change the engine and just go out again the next time. But it did make it very much like mini Formula One at that time. And you knew back then you were being watched in the same way that kind of Formula One teams look at the Formula Two screens on the weekend. You knew if you did the right thing, you'd be in a good place.
Yeah, I actually never got the opportunity to drive one of those cars. So I would say the most downforce or whatever I ever drove in junior Formula, at least, was the 2012 World Series. So after we were teammates in 2011, the new car for 12 was, the super planted one. And I'm pretty jealous, like you say, that I didn't get to drive those cars. And I know you boys did. If we take it to 3.5, it'd be interesting from my point of view as well, because we were teammates, why you found it slightly more difficult, because obviously you were at the top of 2 litre Renault, should have arguably won the championship, right at the top winning, I think you won 4 or 5 races in Formula 3 against people that went on to Formula 1 for whatever reason. Did you find it slightly more difficult because of the power, or what was it?
Yeah, I think I suited a little bit more downforce to less power weight ratio, maybe. I mean, it probably more of an excuse than anything else, but the big thick tyre of the Michelin at that time and the way the World Series drove just didn't quite sit in the same way that I was used to it. And the corners were a little bit more V'd off than they were the minimum speed carrying the Formula 3 that was maybe a little bit more underpowered. But that being said, kind of now getting into the GT style stuff, I'm kind of back into a rhythm again. And really, because of that, you'd think GT stuff wouldn't suit. Just didn't quite see eye to eye with it. And then I tried it again with Fortec in 2012 in the newer, more planted car, which was really enjoyable to drive. But still, I just knew straight away that I had that feeling. I had a good couple of races at the beginning. I think in Monza, I was fourth, and first, second, and third was like Stoffel. Stoffel, Nasr, and then Magnussen, and then me, and I was like, okay, well, I'm in the top 4 or 5, so I knew I was there or thereabouts. So I'm probably being a little bit harsh on myself, but I wasn't used to, if I wasn't on pole, I was upset. That's how I was kind of in my career all the way up till then. And then it was like, oh, top 5's now a nice place to be, but I didn't enjoy that. I didn't enjoy thinking if I'm fifth, I'm happy with that. So that's why I did take that move to the States, because I wanted those poles, wins, and fastest laps again.
Yeah, no, I bet. And actually, that year you were teammates with Stoffel. How was he? Obviously, he's super, super quick, and he got his stint in Formula One, and unfortunately, it didn't happen for him for whatever. But was he the best driver you ever drove against? Because he looks super, super good. Or what was your view on his performances?
He's really, really quick. Best drivers I've ever drive again. I mean, he's definitely in the kind of top 3 or 4. Vernon Collado definitely were up there as well in terms of sure. People. And this Nick Yellerly kid was really quick that I drove with a lot.
I'll give you 20 quid later.
He was very clinical, very quick. And that year really worked for him. He did all the right things. He had everyone behind him. So he definitely felt like he had the team behind him. And that's not making excuses for myself, but he definitely had it all in one place and made the most of it. And I think he just missed out to Magnussen, but it was a very close battle. He's super quick, but I'll say that about anyone who's quicker than me. I'll just say they're amazing.
They must be Lewis Hamilton that never got the chance. Yeah, so after that, you say you went to America, and I've only had a couple of experiences racing out there. I raced Sebring at the end of last year, and it's the most fun I think I've ever had apart from the Nordschleife, if I'm honest. You moved out there, and I think you lived in Indy from what I remember. Talk us about, obviously, making a big move out there, the racing in general. Maybe we don't need to talk about the ovals because we've talked about that a little bit. And just, maybe do you regret coming back, or what was the situation?
There's probably only two things I regret in my career, and it's probably not doing an extra year in Formula 3, for instance, I think, I don't know if Nasr won it the year after, or Felipe Nasr, or whoever it was who won it the year after, who was maybe 12th when I came third that year. So that was one thing I regret. And then maybe not giving America a bit more of a chance, because I did love it. I went out there, my first two races, it was me, Hinch, and Newgarden on the podium, and they'd been in it all year, and I was coming in midpoint to try a couple of races before I started the next year. So it was good. English guy coming into America was still a good thing for brands out there as well. So after those couple of podiums, I got the Lucas Oil deal for Sam Schmidt car. So they were one of the top teams. It was Sam Schmidt versus Andretti then. in Indy Lights. So, and part of that commitment was I had to move out there. They would not give me that Lucas Oil car and that sponsored car unless I lived out there. I went to the factory every single day. So yeah, it was a big commitment. Loved it. Indianapolis isn't the most exciting place in the world, but as a racing driver, it's the committed place to be. And the English accent definitely helped in the spare time I had off. So that was good fun. yeah, it was good life, good racing. Street tracks and road course were awesome. Ovals at the time, we didn't even have any of kind of the kind of side pods, should I say, not that it's like a go-kart, but it was all fully open wheel. So there was even side drafting there. So like my first oval, we were like 209 mile an hour or something instead of 240 in the IndyCar. And then cars are coming up and then tucking their wheels in between your two wheels to just save like a couple of hundredths in drag and then pulling back out again. And I'm just like, I loved it when I was alone, but I didn't really like the oval racing in that particular car. Now, but that being said, if someone called up and said you can do the Indy 500, I would just literally grow a pair and go and do it.
If I remember at the time, did you spoke to Dario, didn't you, for some advice about Dario Franchitti, obviously. Did he sort of tell you or advise you whilst you were out there about how to sort of get the most out of it?
Yeah, he was really helpful and he was still, I think it was his last year or second to last year, maybe racing at the time. I have fond memories of asking him for advice and it probably picking his brains a bit too much, but a couple of pictures from some poles and wins where I'd always kind of go up to Darren and be like, oh, look what I've done, you know give me a seat in IndyCar.
Like I said, the American dream, it's super super good. And like you talk about the ovals, I noticed, or I've definitely seen over the past couple of years, more people actually deciding just to commit to the street courses. You know, you've just had the big name Romain Grosjean move across from Formula One. You also Max Chilton, who we both know a couple of years ago decided also to give that seat up in the Carlin car and let Conor Daly do it because Conor's number one, clearly a lunatic and very good at the ovals. So I can completely see and vouch for your standpoint. With the safety now, like you say, on the Indy cars, the last unfortunate incident was with someone, again, we both raced with Robert Wickens. It's great to see him now driving a car last week in Real again. But do you think you would, or you would be much happier in an Indy car than those crazy Indy Lights then?
Yeah, I think I would be. I mean, I still probably wouldn't. I would still, and I love that it's accepted that in America and in IndyCar you can do a road course program and an oval program. That's amazing. And I think people really respect the danger in that sense. I think in Europe, if you only picked what tracks you wanted to race on, then people would be so confused and you wouldn't think you're a proper racing driver. Whereas out there, they respect how dangerous it is. And if you want to be a road course driver, like Mike Conway was towards the end, I think he switched to only road courses, and a few other people with Dale Hart's team and so on have done that. That's respected, and I think Max made a good decision to do that. I would have probably done the same in his situation. When you can choose to do that, that's great. And I believe he obviously still does the Indy 500, so that's probably what I would do. Would be only do the 500 and then do the road courses for the rest, because the cars are more spaced out now. Aero screen, the wash off the cars means you can't get as close, but when you do get a run, you overtake and then you create a gap. So you're not. I mean, that Vegas race back then was just 230 mile an hour, but your nose was on the gearbox of the other car and you could just hold 50 degrees of lock-in. It was just still easy flat. So that's when it was dangerous. But now that there's gaps in the cars, it's a lot better.
How hard actually is the oval stuff? Because I don't want to sound like a complete, Billy here and not have a clue, but, there's guys like Felix Rosenquist. I think even I'm not sure how Alex Palou is doing on the oval stuff. But obviously, guys like them, they come over and yourself even doing really well on the street courses, even, which is what we kind of know them for in Europe. And then go on to the oval stuff. And I think Felix kind of struggles if I take him as an example. So how it obviously isn't easy, but just watching it on TV, you are just turning left a lot of times. So it's
I knew you were going to say that.
But it is though. But it is. I don't have a clue about it, unfortunately. But that's what I'm trying to. That's what I'm asking Ollie.
I was totally the same before I did it, and now it's actually my favourite race, which is really bad as a big F1 fan. It's my favourite race to watch, the Indy 500, and I actually prefer watching the ovals now. So yes, it's impossible to do well without a good car, even more so than any of our racing. You have to have a good car to do well in ovals. You have to be brave or crazy. That is another point. You definitely just cannot do well unless you have both a good car and you're brave or crazy. And then the talent side of it is there. It's very complicated in the sense that I didn't realize how much was involved in terms of knowing your wind direction live every single lap, your weight tracker from front left to rear right in terms of pitching the car in, having to change those amount of points every single corner, and then also knowing if you're in a thicker train of car, how much degree to go with that, and then how much to put your nose out. And it's a bit of a slow game. Your overtakes start 2, 3, 4 laps earlier from the amount of tire wear you put into weight jacket you put into to everything builds up to that overtake. So it is an intelligent form of racing, more so than I thought, which was just turning left. Those overtakes do come. They look like this just happened and you think, well, why didn't you just do that 4 laps before? But it takes a while to get them up. But yeah, without a good car and without a decent set of balls, you can't make use of that anyway.
That's what it looks like. That's what it looks like. It looks very, very specialist, at least. If we move on to then moving to sports cars, obviously, I think you went straight into ELMS with Alpine at the time, or Alpine, however we're going to say it, and were quite successful. So you did the ELMS and Le Mans. Talk us about that switch from, obviously, you were racing single-seaters beforehand, whether it was in Europe or in America. How was that move over to sports cars for you?
Yeah, really enjoyable. I'd had one or two experiences at, I think, either Dubai 24 Hours or maybe it was Spa 24 Hours the year before with Merck, and really enjoyed the ability to want your teammate to be as quick as you and that kind of less selfishness. And I've always been very good at working with my engineer. And like I said earlier on, is getting to that kind of 95% quite quickly with a car. I enjoyed working with the team. So now I had other drivers around me as well, where I was always quite quick off the block. I blended really well into that team. So I had to do a bit of a shootout to get the drive. That was already quite exciting for me, and to be part of a manufacturer with Alpine, with Renault, it all felt quite serious and quite exciting. I'll admit I'd never been to Le Mans or even kind of watched it in full. Well, not in full, obviously no one really watches it in full, but I hadn't really committed my attention to Le Mans that much in the past, as any of us kind of do outside of our field of sport until you get older. We're all quite kind of a bit, maybe I shouldn't speak for you guys, but I was anyway. You're all so focused on what you're doing and almost a bit ignorant to the outside world of motorsport until you're older.
Yeah. Appreciate
it. I hadn't even been to Le Mans, the Bugatti track, let alone the track, until I actually got there. And it was like the third race of the year. And I was like, oh, this place is actually quite popular. There's quite a few people here. And didn't realize how insane and crazy this race was. And, you know, even at the end of it, I was like, oh, we've got a podium. That's pretty cool. And I was like, everyone seems to be really happy about this. and then you realize kind of 4 or 5 years later, having, you know, not gotten the podium, you're like, oh, that was a really good first year. I should have enjoyed that a bit more. But yeah, that year was amazing. It was a quick year. We won the championship and we got a podium at Le Mans. Really enjoyed it, and then I made the step up into world endurance and got to drive some even quicker cars and bigger circuits.
Is Le Mans basically the only place where scrutineering is an event?
Exactly. It's crazy. And last year in kind of the lockdown that they had, it was a very weird Le Mans, like an extended ghost town test day without all of those bits. But everyone actually from the driver's side had so much more energy, because normally you spend 6-7 days before the race even starts of media duties and scrutineering, which is like 5 hours in the town, and then the driver's parade, which is really, really exciting and sucks for you to miss if it's your first ever time, but gave us a load more free time and more energy, because before the race even starts, yeah, honestly, absolutely knackered before the race even starts. And then some bright-eyed, intelligent, well, I don't know if we can swear on podcasts, but funky.
You can. Yeah, if you want.
Decided to put warm up before Le Mans at like 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. On a Saturday morning. So it's the race starts at 3, but we'll get you up at 5 in the morning and we'll see you at the track. So that made it really enjoyable.
Yeah, the big events around that is quite cool though, because we missed that last year at the Nürburgring 24 as well. you know, you end up doing quite well. And for me, there was no fans there. So you do really, really miss that side of things. Obviously, I know from the successes after that, you got involved with the LMP1 thing with bike collars. As a car, seems to be super, super fast in the straight lines, LMP1 in general. This was more on the privateer side. So how was it competing against the big boys when they've got hundreds of millions to spend and obviously you're more on a shoestring budget?
Yeah, it was nice to be, you know, to have the LMP1 badge on the side of the car and getting that drive coming from LMP2. You almost kind of semi-convince yourself, you know, you almost don't want to even look at the history because, like, oh, I've got an LMP1 seat. This is great. And I've won the championship in LMP2. So this is kind of what I should be doing. But really, I think we'd all prefer you guys as well being at the top in LMP2 than kind of just driving around in LMP1. It was really fun to start the testing and to be in the program. And I love the team and their commitment every year to strive to get the results, but the reliability just wasn't there in the past. Hopefully that changes with their new hypercar. But yeah, we had maybe two out of six finishes at Le Mans. The other four weren't even finishes. So that's tough because our main goal was to just be there at the end because there was only five cars, including the two Rebellions. But the Rebellion budget is even five times ours. So it's even compared to the other privateer, we're on a budget that's closer to an LMP2 team almost. But the car, when it works and to drive, my favourite time ever driving that car is always when we're testing because there's less pressure. You can just drive it and we're not kind of out there for 24 hours straight and we can just get to drive this amazingly quick car. And the team got, I think, a lot of unfair stick considering, I think, when you look at kind of the last pole position that like an Audi factory or Porsche before they left had, the Bicolors car is quicker than they were when they were setting pole times at Le Mans. But obviously when you've got Toyota with, you know, 200-300 million that they spend per year, they'll keep progressing that car so that the boundaries keep moving further and further. So although we're only, in inverted commas, 3 seconds off or 2 seconds off a Toyota around Le Mans, sometimes for a privateer team, their goal is to look back and go, actually, 2 years ago, the Audi was on pole and we're 4 seconds quicker than them. And we're only spending, you know, a small percent. So it's small victories when you're with a privateer team. So it is interesting going from factory teams to privateer and seeing that difference in mentality and difference in goalposts.
How is the new hypercar project looking for the team? Because obviously we've seen the first race with Toyota now, and I think, is there an Alpine car, I think, as well, maybe, there. But how is that looking for a team like Bicolors?
Yeah, so they're going to be testing this year. They were going to enter, but in the end decided, because there's so few cars, Glickenhaus pulled out of the first round as well. I'm not sure if they're doing the next one. They thought, well, we'll actually do something which they haven't done before, which I'm glad they're doing, is test for the year rather than rush the car because it wasn't quite going to be ready for the first round and just test all year or the second half of the year, should we say, so that when they do come into it, they have a better fighting chance because they're still probably not going to be able to compete against the Toyotas, or definitely not. But at least with Glickenhaus and these other manufacturers coming in over the years and hopefully a good BOP, they'll have a better chance. And there will be a strong field because fast forward 2 years, you'll have Peugeot, you'll have Audi, you'll have Porsche, you'll have Toyota, you'll have Glickenhaus, you'll have Bicolors. And then all of a sudden the LMP1 or hypercar category warrants its own category again, which I think in the last 3-4 years, although Toyota are amazing at what they do, they're only against themselves anyway.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And with the, like you said, with LMDH coming in, we're almost coming into another golden era for the top class in sports cars, because you're going to be able to have those guys that say Porsche and Audi. I'm sure others are going to be announced.
BMW, Nick.
Fingers crossed. I'd love to be a part of that if they were to decide to do it, but we'll see on that one. I would say from my point of view, the coolest thing is that these LMDHs anyway will be able to race in both the States, in IMSA and in WEC. So I would say this could be really, really exciting. How do you feel about it, Ollie, with the LMDH coming in? Because obviously you're part of at the championship already. So obviously you're eyeing a seat or wanting to get your ass in a seat if possible.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. I actually had a seat with a particular manufacturer who I won't talk about, but I had my first ever experience of kind of last minute not getting the seat, which I either know very early if I'm not getting the seat or last minute get a seat, whereas this time I was in a seat all the way up until the last minute, and I think a very well-known driver became available, and understandably so, got that last seat. So I've had some ups and downs this year, that's for sure, but hopefully in the next couple of years when the new manufacturers come in, I'll have another shot at it. But I think if it's done right, it will be a great thing. The rules need to change a little bit more stricter so that the car actually looks like a hypercar rather than an LMP1 car. It's a very, very tough thing for the championship to rearrange, because the issue isn't now. The issue started in 2015 when the new LMP2 cars came out and the new Orica and the new Ligier got designed, because the grey area in the rules for the LMP2 category then, they basically made an LMP1 car, there's LMP2 cars. So to give you an idea, between, I think, 13 and 14, an LMP2 car went 9 seconds quicker round Le Mans and its pole time when they changed the chassis and the rules to the new Orica. And all of a sudden, you've now got this LMP2 class, which is far too quick for its own good, which means when they now brought out the hypercar class, they're having to do all these crazy things to slow everyone else down, because to make a hypercar look like a hypercar and be slow enough to be a hypercar, all of a sudden the LMP2s are too quick. So without going around the houses too much, I think LMDH will be great. It should come back to that GT1 era that everyone loved back in the day of Le Mans. You see old pictures of the F1, Porsche GT1 and all those at the front of the field and the Mercs and kind of Weber coming down over the bumps. And it's an amazing, amazing era. And that will only come back if they, A, slow the LMP2s down, and B, stricten up the rules so that these LMDH cars look a lot more like the hypercars of the road. And then I think it will bring that wider audience back in.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And you can see that hopefully that will happen. And if not, we've always got IMSA to watch the LMDH and the GT Pros coming around. A couple more questions before obviously we leave you. How did you get your social media so good?
Yes, that one. So that kind of naturally came through. So in school, when I realised at this kind of age of 14, 15, when I got into T-cars and then got into Renault, I was so dedicated and focused. Once I kind of had this kind of spell of in karting, maybe we won't do this. And then we went to T-cars and we committed to it. Every part of me from 14, 15 years old onwards lived and breathed racing. And what that meant was when I was choosing my subjects in school and for A-level, I would just pretty much only pick anything that would help me be quicker in a car. And you think, well, what at school can help you be quicker in the car? Well, not much really, other than sport. Okay, so what can help me gain sponsorship so that I can keep racing and being the best car? Okay, so I'll do economics, business studies, and then I'll do photography and videography so I can make like cool reels for my video for my sponsors and stuff like that. And at the time I'm 15, you know, I'm making like videos for like companies like Shell and BP and sending them off, and they're going in junk email boxes. And, you know, I'm batting way above my average, both in sponsorship and in women at that age. And I'm trying everything I can. And in the end, naturally, I was always kind of the first one in early to get with kind of with Facebook and then with PDFs. And then I was very old school with my sponsorship, going in and cold calling companies. And when Instagram came about, I started it quite early and thought, well, I'll just use this as my like sticker book for my little videos that I make around the track. And I'll just kind of show people the cool stuff that I get to do, because that's really cool. And as well as kind of the like Coca-Cola sticker that I'm going to get millions for on the side of the car, I'll make them a little video and put it to my 7 fans on Instagram. And that passion of just wanting to do that to make sure that I can keep racing, because that was the only reason I was doing it, merged together with this world in the last 5 years that meant, you know, now kind of with the kind of over the 3 channels that I've got, over the 400,000 followers I've got, it's almost flipped to some partners I speak to are like, oh no, we can't be seen to actually put a logo on the car, but we'd love to do some stuff with you online. So now it's this crazy new world where they just need eyes and numbers. So if I can show them that, you know, some championships I'm in, for instance, in GT Cup, I have more viewers per week on just my Instagram page than GT Cup get in a whole race weekend. So if you can offer that out to them and then, you know, bump up sponsorship because of that, then, you know, you're in a better team. Or if you're in a team that, for instance, if I'm in a couple of championships where you're in a free drive and you're not getting paid a salary, like a manufacturer drive, then you can take the sponsorship and earn that as a salary, because that's what a lot of racing is about. Because just getting one manufacturer drive is hard enough, but if you're racing in a few other championships, you've kind of got to earn that money somehow. And that's why I delved into all those different areas, from social media to kind of stunt driving, presenting and commentating and all that other stuff, because I just want to do anything and everything around motorsport, not just the driving bit.
Yeah, no, as someone, so here at HYM, I and Fatula, who's behind the scenes behind the camera today, we went to a college course that was it was a broadcast college course. So we did everything from film, TV to radio and beyond. And that's how we've got our skill set for the HYM podcast. But, you know, as someone who I've done that, to look at what you've done, I think that's a pretty amazing to see that things like that have such an impact.
Yeah, and I think, and just like you guys have got your skill set to be able to do that in this world, I think that just, it can only benefit, as long as it's not a distraction. I always said to myself, that's why I don't do to the degree of YouTube videos. So I have a YouTube channel, but I don't do anything with it, because that extra commitment and that jump to do an actual vlog or videos and actually be, and to a point, the stigma of actually having a camera in the racing paddock when you're meant to be a professional racing driver and doing your job. The outside world, it's a mix of, we need to be doing our job and we don't have time for that. And also the outside world aren't quite there yet to know that you can split your time. So for me, 20 minutes each evening on Instagram, put up a video or edit an onboard that I've got. Oh, hey guys, I got to drive a P1 GTR today. You know, that's a kid's dream to drive that car. I'm very lucky. Post it up. Is nice and easy. If I went into the realm of YouTube, it would distract me from my racing, and I'm not committed to do that. So I'm happy to spend, you know, 10, 20 minutes a day on what I do online, but the rest is still fully focused on my career at the moment, which is the actual in-car stuff.
Yeah, well, we're going to be doing some YouTube videos, so it'd be massive, and it'd be great to get you on one of those one day. But quickly before we wrap it up, you said you're a massive F1 fan. Give us your prediction for the champion this year.
I mean, I want it to keep being as close a battle as possible, and I was really, really hoping that Verstappen got the last win, so that at least it's kind of a bit one apiece and would have been a bit equal. But I think it's kind of got to be Lewis. I honestly believe that Red Bull car is slightly quicker this year, but Lewis is just unbelievable. And I think he's a prime example of someone who is showing the outside world that as long as you're focused when you need to be on what you do, he can have this kind of side life that people, I think, used to but no longer judge him for, because he is so good at what he does, and when he needs to, he spends the time on his craft. The fact that he can have that many distractions in his life and still be that good when Verstappen is literally solely focused on beating him is mighty impressive. So I think it's going to have to be Lewis again.
Yeah, what's the saying? You can't switch on if you don't switch off.
Yeah.
So yeah. Oh, I like that, Alex.
And on that note,
write that down now.
And same on that note, my next Instagram post caption.
get us a picture of a sunset and a motivational quote with my name under it. But we're going to wrap it up there, boys. Ollie, thanks for coming on the podcast this week. Really, really insightful to hear everything you have to say. And good luck for this year in all the championships.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been really fun, and hopefully we can have a recap at the end of the year, and I'll let you know how many classic cars I've put in the gravel.
Exactly. So we'll do that for sure. And thanks to everyone for listening to the HYM podcast. New episode every Wednesday. And thanks for supporting the channel over the past few weeks, and it's going to keep rolling onwards. So cheers, guys, and catch you in the next one.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.